Continuing at 12 o'clock with, that's day one, where's the other one? That's day one. Anyway, I've got the cards here. I think it's Mark Downey. Then at 12 o'clock, and then there shall be lunch at 1 o'clock. Then we continue with Kate Sikio. 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 And after that, Herbert Lachmai. I can't see him here now, but I'm sure he will join later on. As a very busy man, so like everybody else. And the final presentation will be Lev Ledit. So, any questions regarding the organizational things today? There'll be breaks in between. And, of course, please do write down questions if you have any during the presentations. It'd be nice to have a discussion afterwards. We have approximately 20 minutes for a discussion. Yesterday we were very punctual, which was very unusual, because everybody kept to their schedule. It was wonderful. So, yes, very unusual. So shall we, let's start with the first presentation, Toxic Dreams. First, there will be Josie Van Nunu, the director of Toxic Dreams, who will be giving an introduction to Toxic Dreams. And continue. Michael Strawman is here. He will continue. And basically, Toxic Dreams was founded in 1997 by Cornelia Kilga. She's the producer, together with Josie Van Nunu. And associate members are Michael Strawman. He's responsible for video and music. And Irene Coticchio and Anna Mendelssohn, they are both performers, but not here today. Toxic Dream resists, I'll just quote a few captions of your abstract. Toxic Dreams resists objects to the importance given to the text over the aspects of performance, actors, set, music, media, etc. They think that the best way to view their shows is to accept confusion as part of the experience of sitting in the theatre. They put shows on that ask the audience to make up its own mind. We don't know better, they say. So, Toxic Dreams will present a presentation called Mise en Scène, and it's regarding reading and staging political acts, interpretation as an exercise of power, and visualizes over a number of productions. Toxic Dream visualizes over a number of productions the play of meaning across a field of knowledge. It visualizes the process that grants certain aggressive voices the status of cultural history and excludes the voices of the disenfranchised. Be interesting to hear what that means. When a text is re-examined over a couple of performances, it allows us to dramatize history's reliance on the written text and its exclusion of those points of view, tentative and impermanent, which are not written down, not subject to the linearity of writing. So, yes, please welcome Josie Van Nunu. He shall be starting with a presentation. Thank you.
Hi. I will not get too much into the Toxic Dream production because I think we don't have a lot of time. So if you are interested, you can go to our website and there's quite extensive documentation of everything we do. And you can look at it there. I would just say that we are basically a group of people who are working together for quite a long time, and the group is mixed. We are not a traditional theater group or performers group in that sense that we have a director, actors, and etc., but we have a lot of people that come from media, music, and visual art that work with us together, and the project we make varied from, I would say, more classical theater shows to an installation that presents more in a visual art context. This is just a general overall. To give you an idea of our next production, in autumn we will do a sort of a kind of a church sermon that's called The Church of Warren Buffett, that's based on an article we read in Harper magazine. Then in December we will do part two of a project, a long-term project we are working on the 60s and the assassination of JFK. And in between we are doing a project with Wien Museum, which call exhibition for one night, when we have a series of evening when we present parts from their archive that usually nobody sees, but it's a one-night exhibition and presenting the item in a more performative way, so trying to propose a different way to view exhibition. So this is kind of just a rundown in the project we have in the autumn. I thought that I would just talk about how we develop a piece, and then Michael, I guess, will try to give you a more concrete idea that have to do with an opera we did last year. Basically, I would say that we start from a very specific place. We are not designing a show without the theater in mind. And we take the place that we're working in as a given. So when we start to work, the place and everything around it is part of our concept. We are not trying to bring a set or to bring a piece into a theater and trying to give the audience the feeling that now you're going to go with us in for the next 2 hours in some different place. But from the beginning, there's the theater room and then the room we create. It's kind of in a room within a room. And we always start with a very specific setting. So we don't develop it, but when the people come in, they enter into a specific setting. And it's usually a public setting. I have a bit of a problem with the development of theater into what you call an intimate places. The idea was that we build sort of the living room or a set that looks like your apartment, your house in the theater, sort of the realistic, naturalistic theater when people were very happy that they can see their life on stage and feel really comfortable about it. For me, theater was always sort of a public meeting when people come to discuss with each other. So the places that we are usually building are sort of public spaces. It can be an hotel lobby, it can be a courtroom, it can be a committee, it can be a train station, hallway, whatever, but the places are always places that we kind of make it clear to the audience, this is a public meeting. We are here to talk. And most of the shows start by also us, either a performance or a text, declaring to the audience quite clear what is the space and what we expect from them. What is their role? So it's kind of we are totally setting up the relationship we are going to have tonight. And this relationship change over time. This is about the general setup. In that sense, entrance and exit are the most important things in the way we mark the space. For example, if we always start by, or most of the time we start by, the audience come in, we don't turn off the light is on, we enter, we say good evening, this is that and that and that. Usually we employ kind of a master of ceremony role, but it can change from production to production. In the last production, for example, we were all sitting already reading a newspaper about the assassination of JFK, sort of like a replica of an old newspaper, but it was very clear that when the audience came in, it's like the room looks like a committee that there to investigate the death of JFK. And on the video behind us, we screen also photos of us reading the newspaper in a tram on Vienna and also showing the original photos of people reading about the assassination of JFK in New York in 1963. So basically the audience can kind of track down all the references that leads to the image that they see when they enter into the theater. I like this quotation of, I forgot his name, the French artist who said he hates this idea that he goes to the theater, light goes off, and then it starts. And I totally agree about it, that this notion that you see it, light goes off, and then life starts is just something that I disagree with. The problem I also have with the intimate places, because I think they allow the audience to they allow the audience some way to kind of to take themselves out, to kind of to sit in the dark and see what's going on. And this is something that I find wrong in terms of the security that the audience will feel. So there's different way to deal with it, and I if you want, we can talk about it later in detail. But I like this article I read once in the New York Times about business people who travel a lot, and they like their hotel room so much that they ask interior designer to design their bedroom to look exactly like the hotel room they like. So you have these people who have like kind of their bedroom looks like the Hyatt or the Hilton. And this is for me maybe kind of an interesting take about this kind of the intimate space. After we set up the space, let's say it's a committee room, the performers and the people who work on a piece take their places without a particular order. So I'm, for example, as the director from outside, I'm not creating any setting. I'm not creating any setup. People sit whenever they want to sit, and we start. I'm kind of interesting to see, like, today how people arrange themselves in the space without any particular mise-en-scène, without any particular blocking. And what happened is that this is how we start. Now, since the place is defined, there's tables, there's chairs, this microphone, there's a committee, whatever. People tend to organize themselves in a space and find the places that are warm to them. So if you will have the performers that, you know, likes to push it, they usually will sit in the center place near the mic, check out that it's loud, and feel really comfortable there. While maybe you have new people that working with there that will take kind of the side chair there and wait for their cue. And what is interesting that they start to do the text from this particular position. So for example, if you don't know the text very well and you feel kind of insecure, you will probably sit on the back and kind of almost whisper it, which is very interesting because this is where I start to like it, because the people are starting to inhibit the space in a way that I will never be able to imagine if I will do proper blocking. And what is also interesting about it, that this has become part of the process. We kind of, everybody is kind of mapping their own territory. Everybody sitting in a place that is comfortable to them. And we keep on going like this, and it never changes. And it also ends up being like this on the show. So we basically, if we have a table or if we have a setup that, let's say a lecture setup, if you feel like getting up, taking a glass of water, crossing the stage, whatever, you just do it because that's what we rehearse for a month and a half or 2 months. There's a certain natural aspect to it. Of course, there are scenes that are highly structured. When we do dances or when we do scenes that are quite frontal and have to present something, we work on them separately. But the movement around the space, the movement around the territory, it's organic because it tried out. One thing that for me, I always think that after a while, the performers know better than me about the space because they are the one who's sitting there. They are the one who inhibit the space. So they know better than me about how do they feel. If I sit out and try to organize and say, no, you sit there right now or you stand in the wall, I'm basically creating a situation that maybe I have it in my head, but I think it's much better to go with how people feel in the room, how comfortable they are within a certain setup. And since we start from the beginning in a very clear room, for the audience, it's very clear where they are. If they are in a committee place, if they are in train station, et cetera, et cetera. And then we start to work with the text that we prepare. The text usually, some of it is a lot of pages that we have to find out by doing which text fits, which text does not fit. And we also have to feel what feels right when you speak it. So there's a lot of trial and error there. But the important things about the text, that I'm a big follower of Gertrude Stein, And Gertrude Stein wrote already in the 60s about theater that the problem with theater was that you either were in front of it, so you knew what was going on and you were kind of bored, or you were before it. You were trying to figure out something that happened before, but the play kept on moving. But you were never in the moment. You were never in this just, you know, smelling the flowers. So for us, when we work at this kind of a system of beginning again and again and again, or what she called a continual presence, which means that we get bored very fast, and then we restart. Get bored, restart. Every couple of lines or every couple of scenes, we bored. And after a while, I realized, but something is missing there. Because we restart, but sometimes we don't know how to continue. And I came up with this idea that I call it office party. And the idea of office party is very simple. You know, I never worked in an office, so it's all something that I'm assuming. But I saw a lot of movies on TV, so my ideas about office is coming more from movies and TV. And in this sense, you sit in your office, you work in a computer, and maybe you suddenly dream. You zoom out for a second. Or your boss in many, many movies, the moment the boss goes to the toilet or something, everybody is getting wild. So we devise this thing, so it's called office party, which means that every time we're stuck, we go into a dance. A dance that is a total senseless release of energy in the room. It's like office party, and everybody can go for 1 minute for no reason whatsoever, and then we reorient it again, and then we continue. The problem was that during the year, the office party became the main thing, and the text got kind of a second hand, got into the second level, which is, I have no problem with it, but it's, I think for many people in the audience, they start to ask themselves, why are we having these epileptic dances in between this serious text about murder and et cetera. That was the device. The other thing is that in terms of the text, because I think that part of the reason we are here is also because text in theater is a very important the interpretation of the play, and I have to say in that respect I'm a very disrespectful person to the big writer. When we use a play a lot of time, we hardly do a full play from beginning to an end. We always use just part of it, and when we feel that this doesn't fit our I would say particular things we want to say, we change things, or we rewrite it totally. So, for example, something that I forgot to say in the beginning that maybe we'll explain it. We work in what we call cycles. So we don't work per production, but we define an area of interest to us. For example, right now we are in what we call the political cycle, and then for the next 4 years, we are basically working only with this question, what is political theater, or what is political performance, or what is political art nowadays? And all our performances or events are geared toward this question. So for 4 years, we basically just, whatever we do is just about the question, what is the right format to do political theater, how you mix academic text and speech, et cetera. In that sense, now I lost my track of thought because I want to decycle. Yeah. So when we come into this decision of what text to do, if you take, for example, we did what we call the theater cycle, when we asked ourselves what to do in theater nowadays, because theater seems to be quite a drag on everybody. You mention theater and everybody say, oy vey, you know, theater is like, sounds very old-fashioned and kind of so uncool to be a theater artist. So we ask ourselves a question, and as one of the main projects that we did in the theater cycle was taking Uncle Vanya by Chekhov and redoing it for over 4 years. And one of the questions we ask is, what is realism? So the first thing we did, we went to Russia, and we filmed the play in a place it was written, in Chekhov's house. because we wanted to see how does it feel, how does this play feel when you really do it in the realistic place, but not in a realistic place built in a theater, but in the actual place that was built in Russia. And then the second part, we thought, let's try to extract the text into the, we call it to the bone. In that sense, so we wrote an opera, was called Pink Vanya, when we reduced Chekhov into the most basic things. Every text, we just wanted to say, does the character say, I love you, I hate you, I'm tired, I'm hungry, I'm bored. So all the opera was very much about, I love you, I hate you, I'm tired, I'm bored. To music. And we decided to call it Pink Vanya because we wanted to turn Chekhov into a really lovely pink music, which didn't really happen because Michael wrote a quite complex and sometimes sad music, but at least the stage was pink. But my point is that while many people in theater will take a text and then spend a lot of time trying to build a certain arc, trying to talk about the character emotional development, and then sit in a rehearsal and trying to find it. And what I hate about it that I sit in the theater and then I know he will now say this and this line, and I know how he says it, and I can totally figure out, okay, here he means to signal me this and that. For example, you take To Be or Not To Be, and then you work on it, that I will stop after the first B, and I will go faster after the second B, and this is kind of a sort of notation that classical theater is doing on a daily practice. With us, it's a bit different, and this I have to say, I learned the system very much from the Worcester group. It's much more about what we call task-oriented acting, where you take a text and then you start to chew it and you never stop. And every night is different, and every night, the more you get familiar with the text, the more you chewing become better. But basically, the rehearsal is not about trying to achieve something, trying to reach a certain end when then you replicate it night by night. But it's about keep on living this text in the rehearsal and then in the performances while you're doing it and keep on chewing it on a daily basis. And then what is interesting is every text, the same text can come totally different in different nights. It can be a really funny text one night and it can be a total tragic text one night. The problem with it is very risky because we have shows that in one evening, the audience is really laughing, and in the second evening, it's total quiet. And the performers get totally insecure because they think we are doing something wrong. Because the night before, the people were laughing. What is going on? And to get into this comfort zone when you realize that you just produce something totally different with the same thing tonight is something that took a lot of time to achieve. I think now our performers they have less fear. They are not sitting there saying the line, and if the audience don't laugh, they are totally. I think in terms of I will stop. I will stop here and give it to Michael, and then I guess we can talk about it.
We'll talk about an opera we did about. I can say this.
Okay.
It's in my text.
Bye.
Yeah, so I wanted to be more, a bit more specific about an opera that we did last year. The opera was about, it was set as a talk show between Friedrich August von Hayek and John Maynard Keynes, and they were in the piece invited to discuss their economic ideas. So we had, as a cast, we had two opera singers, Maynard Keynes and Hayek, but the MC, the talkmaster, was an actress, and she couldn't really sing. So I had to come up with an idea that's musical, but that you could do it, that you could perform. So as an orchestra, I used the Invisible Hand Orchestra, which was two computer-controlled pianos, a Bösendorfer and a Yamaha. And in my preparation, I came across the work of Peter Ablinger and Winfried Rich, whom they... I guess you can even see it in the Ars Electronica Center. They used a computer-controlled piano and used it as a speech vocoder so that they could make the pianos talk. And I thought, great, the actress can talk, the piano talks, so if they talk together the same text, that's cool. And And then, because then I wouldn't throw, fall out of my musical setting with the piano sound. And that's what I want to walk you through, how this is technically, how I technically did it. So I had to record the text from Anna, and then I had to transform it, the analog audio, into MIDI data so that the piano can understand it. And then play back the text via MIDI, and the actress had to be in sync with what she said before. Like, so, yeah. You have this text.
Okay. Strike out that last question. But gentlemen, what is the reason for this swing? Why do we keep on...
And then I use this software, it's called Spear, which does a Fourier transformation of the audio stream and formats into something that's called sound description interchange format. SDIF, sound description interchange, yeah. So we do it here. It's analyzing it, and then if you play it back, it's like the reverse Fourier transformation, but with sinusoids. So it's a bit more packed together, not just the single sine tones that you would get from a reverse Fourier transformation, but already packed in sinusoids.
Okay.
Oh fuck! Why? Okay, this is going to be a bit lower now, level-wise, because I cannot put this on this output. I'm sorry. But maybe last chance. Yeah, I'm sorry, but I can make it louder than in the next step. But this would be here would be already too much data for the pianos to play back. So I had to get rid of all the partials that would be below minus 40 decibel. It would sound like shit. It's bad. Okay, I mean, you would still get... Let's see, maybe it's here. No. Part of my presentation is gone now. And then you would get rid of the partials that shorter than 100 milliseconds, and you would get rid of all the frequencies that would be above, let's say, 8,000 hertz, because the piano cannot replicate this anyway. So, you save it, and the next step would be to go to max, because I had to change the format from the sound description interchange format into a MIDI format, and this I could only do in max, so you would load it and play it back here.
Okay.
Why is it not sparking? It's really interesting. Ah. I shouldn't have closed the computer, Yossi. Now I will lose this. because you didn't even use this. Oh, my God. And then it's always my fault. It's not really what I... There is one step missing. But that's what you would get then if you played back from the piano. So if you knew the text before, I guess I have to play it to you again.
Okay. Strike out that last question. But gentlemen, what is the reason for this swing? Why do we keep on...
Okay, that's how it would sound then in the piano. Yeah, it's kind of a appropriation of the text. So if you knew what she's talking about, then you could more or less also understand it by the piano. And I had to tweak it a bit so that it would fit to the other parts of the music. So in the end, it would sound like this. I did pitch the notes a bit so that they would fit to the harmonic structure of the music that was before and after. And in the end it would, that's just a short bit of documentation of this bit.
Okay, strike out the last question. But gentlemen, what is the reason for this crisis? Why does the economy work?
Why? Things go up, things go down. It's like the economy expands itself. Sooner or later, it's cyclical. The economy is self-regulating like a sick person. It's selfish. The economy has an automatic adjustment mechanism. Things go up, things go down, it's cyclical, but the economy is like a thermostatic system. Sometimes it has a very high, very high, very high fever, but it automatically adjusts its temperature, it automatically adjusts its temperature to any change in the weather. So things go up and then they go down. And life becomes balanced again. Because it's cyclical. It's cyclical.
Yes, but are you implying that everything is just a minor hiccup? A slight adjustment of this economic thermostat?
Yes, yes.
Yep. Yes, yes. So, of course, it was difficult for the performer to be really precise with the very strict timeline that we had, because in this logic thing, everything, the whole show was written in stone, basically, because the light and video and everything, every change in the show was in this timeline. And they couldn't move anywhere. They were totally constrained to this timeline. Which was also a good thing, because we don't have conductors usually when we do these operas, because we cannot afford them, and so it's better if they cannot go anywhere. But this process, I wanted to show this example because I think that this process of devising the map out of the territory, where the territory would be the audio file, the actual text, and then reducing it to this MIDI data. I used it at least in this project. I used it quite often also to feed street sounds or rhythmic stuff into the into this Fourier transformation into MIDI thing to come up with new ideas that I wouldn't have beforehand. And but also there's a, it's something that's playing the how do you call it, the classical notation a bit ad absurdum, because then the stuff would look like this, and it's something that nobody would really come up with. or like this. No, this is actually the stuff that's easier, but where is the... Okay, that's difficult here. Yeah. There is classical notation, but it doesn't help anybody, as you saw. Okay, that's a good, I think. Anyway, yeah, that's it.
Are there any questions, anyone? Yeah? So why do you think nobody would come up with a notation like this?
Because it's too complex to write and impossible to read.
There are composers who exactly are doing this. They write things you cannot play, and they write exactly things you are not able to perform. So it's existing definitely. just to tell you. But it comes from the other way. I mean, there are composers writing music, but it's exactly their intention to write that complex that it's definitely not really possible to perform, because then it will initiate a process in the musician to create something. So it's just the other way around.
But maybe I don't find it. I actually don't know why I don't find it. I don't find it because I know compositions that are complex, but this is usually what the output of the of this sound interchange format thing produces is just more or less black stuff, because it's so full of and even it's even beyond not playable.
And
I think
one more question. So what I didn't really get it. What is the web and what is the territory for you?
The territory was the actual speech, the text spoken by the performer, by Anna. And the map would be the MIDI, the transformation into MIDI.
And the two guys, they were not involved in this process?
No, for them I usually compose differently. I compose like more or less like you would compose normally, like writing notes and stuff.
You mentioned that you don't have a conductor as someone who sort of keeps the various, I presume sort of keeps everything in line, the music gets going and the performers and tries to jump. And I was wondering whether you were mentioning yesterday the use of lights in the way that you were building the pieces, the performers knew where they were because of the light. Are you using something like that where you use light changes and stuff as conducting signs, at least the conductor's telling the actors where to be? Even if there's no feedback, no way to change things?
No, not really. I mean, this was... I wanted to mention it because we did an opera like a couple of years ago where we had a much bigger problem of not having a conductor, because we had live musicians and we had more actors and we had also really heterogeneous cast, like people who couldn't really read notes. They had to learn, for example, their lines by heart, but then we changed from piano accompaniment to the band, and they were immediately completely lost because it sounded differently, and they had to relearn everything again. And then we had, of course, that because in musical timing is super crucial. Of course, you cannot, even if you have a couple of milliseconds later, it's already falling apart, the rhythm. And then we had this classical trained musicians and in combination with more jazz oriented musicians, and they count differently. I mean, they should have the same watch, but the timing in between is completely different for classical musicians than to jazz musicians. And in the end, we just solved it through rehearsal. We just rehearsed it a lot and we learned it by heart, more or less. But it would have helped much to have a composer, but the mise en scène and stuff just didn't allow it in a way.
It's maybe just a boring technical question, but between the bit where you did this, use this software Spear, and then when you showed this analysis, you said this is just missing one step, and I'm wondering what the step was that is missing.
No, the step was I wanted to play the output of Spear together with the MIDI output, because you hear this Fourier transform want whistling, which I don't know why I don't get this. It sounds similar to the Spear output, but I don't know why it doesn't. I really don't know why it doesn't play back. It doesn't accept the, it doesn't recognize the USB output.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
It's actually on, or is it just a...
It's a very silly question, but I think it might relate eventually to our topic here, but you were talking about wanting to make your audience insecure and being against the sort of comfort that you can take in the darkness as an audience member. And if I had to pick a label as an artist, I would probably be a filmmaker. So when I do theater, I'm the guy who takes over the fire exit signs to make it really dark and to make the room disappear. So I guess I'd have the complete opposite response to what I want from theater. And when I go somewhere, usually my problem isn't a lack of insecurity. Yeah. So
your problem is
why should I be insecure when I go and see stuff?
It's a, how should I explain? I think part of it is very much dealing with a certain let's say my interpretation or my take on the Brechtian idea of the fact that I have the feeling that. That if the audience are sitting in the theater and they're feeling secure, they tend to take themselves out of the equation, out of what come out of the stage. So it's easy then in the end of the show to say, "Aha, it's them," because you have the feeling that you can agree with what happened on stage and you are part of the good one, especially in a political theater, by making the audience all the time. Realizing that it's them or it's us and that we are part of a certain system. I keep challenging this notion that you can go after the show and discuss the political topic in the sense that you can basically feel I participated in a really nice cultured evening and now we have the beer after the show and it's really terrible what we're doing to I don't know what to and Bush. So there is a certain necessity of on my part to keep on saying, hey, we are the theater, we are discussing something, and you are part of this discussion. You cannot take back. So this is one way to explain. The other way is what I would say Richard Fuhrman does more, which I also like very much. This tendency to kind of to dream. Or to take yourself away during a show in the dark. So he's from time to time he's flashing white light into the audience eyes to say, "Wake up! You are in the theater. Let's keep on going." So it's in a way, it's not a fantasy movie. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of.
Very practical. How the audience then can be involved in a very. You know, when you say you want to have the audience involved in the discussion, is it possible to discuss with you during the performance?
Some shows, for sure. And people react.
I'm really curious how you do it very practical.
There's different ways. Sometimes it's as simple as that. you can discuss. We also did format like this, for example, when we meet the audience in a restaurant and have a full dinner, 20 people, and eat for 3 hours. And we did a take about my dinner with Andre, which is like, you know, a famous movies about the theater of the 60s. And then we recreated it, but the audience sat with us on the table. And for example, in between every story, and when the food came, we stopped the show, and then it became a conversation. You sit, you talk to people, and then you continue the storytelling, and then you stop. Other shows, for example, it's about forcing the audience to participate by, for example, using technique of TV. So we had people with signs that says, now you have to laugh, now you have to clap, now you have to do this, and we kept on doing, kept on bringing it as a recording of live TV, which forces the audience to react. Other times it's as simple as really asking them, demanding a reaction. It's not always. Sometimes it's working very much straight on, but I think by setting up the situation, and from the and all the time coming back to it and related to it, you don't leave the audience alone. You don't let them this point when they feel protected. And I can say that certain people hate it and they feel not good about it. And in the beginning when we started in Vienna, I mean, people left the theater really angry and called us arrogant and were really angry at us. It took time to transform also that this doesn't come from arrogance, or we are not just trying to provoke you for the sense of provoking, but we are really trying to create a bit of a different relationship.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would hate it or not.
Yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have to try.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily hooked to action for the audience. Yeah, it's I think it's more about techniques to develop to produce the necessity of presence. Being in the moment, what you yesterday you talked about, the being in the now, yeah, for the audience, that they that you cannot go to sleep in the theater, in our theater. This is, it's more, you have to be there in the room, in the, yeah, it's more about that,
to get really full attention and not leave them for toxic dreams.
Yeah, it's also for us it's a way to keep on saying there's different type of conversations. But whatever we do, we are trying. We are not just blocking. But it's difficult because I think that to talk about it, sometimes it sounds, when you talk about it, sounds aggressive or it can sound also childish. I think over time it's much more about comfort that you create in a room. It's much more about that than about anything else. If the feeling that the moment the door closed, we are now together in one room and we're going to have fun for 1 hour, or we're going to be together in a room for 1 hour, and this is a time that everything can happen, the possibilities, then I think that there's more and more openness to it. And I really think that for us, it took some time, but I think the audience that come to see our show now knows it, and there's not this fear. That's one of the things that I always talk about, that in terms of also audience, the theater of 60s done one thing that I hate, that they took audience participation and destroyed for everybody else, for the rest of us, which is really a shame, because there is something about audience participation that I love, but people are, basically, you say, I'm not so sure if I would like it or not. And our try was, in a lot of ways, to do it, but to do it in a way that people can take it.
No, for me personally, it's just, if I have the feeling that, I don't know, with any kind of art, which will tell me that I have to do something, I just don't like it, you know? Yeah. That's or I have to think something special, or I have to do something. It's that, that's just, No way with me.
Fair enough. I don't think that that's what we do, but I also think that if we do it, I think it's quite interesting to do it. Why not? To confront you with your kind of position of saying, I don't like it. I'm thinking for myself. I'm an individual. Don't tell me what to think. I think it's quite interesting if I can confront you with that. If I can confront you with that in your constant need to feel I'm the master of this, then in a room of theater full of other people, it's actually quite interesting to make you maybe ask yourself why I have such a big resistance to it. Why I came this evening to a room and want to share with everybody, and then I keep on saying, no, but I'm... I just wanted to mention one thing, because in the end Michael said he will mention, but he didn't mention. Just think about the opera, because you saw it. The thing in the opera was very simple. It was to try to see on a political level if we can take a pure economic text and stick with it. Not to have any storyline but that. So we choose the setup of talk show, and we made it from the beginning pure. There's a master of ceremony. Many people in the audience thought it's Richard Quest, that we build it on Richard Quest for CNN. There's an economic guy in CNN that actually really talk like that. But we based it actually on a BBC show called Hard Talk, when it's just about you have one person. And the idea there in the opera was, and that's what I think makes life for Michael and the singer very difficult. I wrote a libretto that was pure economic text. Every personal detail that was there, I purposely took out. So my point was, can we tell the political story, but without, because usually political films, they always have the personal things to it, you know, your personal flaw, and I wanted to say, to try there, to see, can we talk about economy, but really just talk about theory, and really try to express. So that was what the opera was about.
Audience feel insecure in that piece, because it played out to a click track, right? I mean, it had the same time every night, and everybody was millisecond accurate, or it all fell apart. So, was that just a straight ahead opera? The audience come in, they watch it.
There in the opera, we used more the Richard technique. We kept on having blinders into the audience eyes. One that you use in rock and roll. So we had this character called the dictionary scrutinizer, which is a kind of a bit of a Zappa idea, where the more the show goes, the less words one can use. So we said tonight we get rid of the word poverty. And then we said, there's no poverty, there's no more poverty, and then the word poverty is broken apart to pop, 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 pop. And so every time somebody tries to say the word poverty, there's a light flashes. But the light is flashes also in the audience in the way, it's like a sort of Men in Black thing. And I think this was irritating, because in a certain point it started to be quite a lot of words are erased, and the audience are sitting there, and they kept on being flashing this word is erased from a dictionary. There's no such thing as a recession. There's no such thing as this. There's no such thing. So that was, I think it was just, and besides the fact that audience, generally speaking, a lot of them have a problem with modern music and with electronic music and whatever. So this is in addition.
I have a question. I'm curious, how do you negotiate the process within the production? You know, from
what
rehearsal?
Do you mean? Sorry, what do you mean in terms of how negotiate in terms of what? In terms of working with the performers? Or?
Yes, the whole, you know, everything from the performers to the music, video, everything, the whole process.
It's two ways. One, sometimes things start with a very clear setup, and then we know what we will have. We know where we have the video projection. We know where everything. And then, in terms of the music on the video, Michael kind of knows where we think it's good to put the video, where it's good to put the music, whatever. And then we talk about it, and then he prepares something. We try a lot of trial and error.
So it's not like a construction that you plan, a big plan. It's just an organic process, in a way.
It's hard to say. It's changed from show to show. The show that we started, for example, we start from nothing. So we have this idea, let's work about King Kong. And then we meet a year before the show and we work for 1 month just trying out things. And then it gives us a year to really think about what to do, writing the process. And then we have a process of discussion. We meet, we discuss the things, we look at things together, we read and blah, blah, blah. So by the time we come into the room and start to work on the rehearsal, we already had a full year of research. But it's changing from time, because the last production, for example, was very difficult because there were really different level of knowledge within the group. Because we went to Dallas, Texas to work on the Kennedy assassination and to film there, and I was like reading for almost a year everything there is to be about this assassination. And then when the actors joined, they read maybe a book or whatever, so there was a different level of building the material. And there, for example, I am the one who is pushing a lot of material in to the process, and then from then on, people are gaining knowledge. But the interesting is that there was a person from outside who came to our rehearsal to view the rehearsal. And after the rehearsal, he said to me, it's amazing how all of you are so knowledgeable about the things of the rehearsal. From outside, it looked different.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Anyone? Then we can close for the next speaker, please. Thank you. Mark Downey, with his presentation Fieldwork, Art as Inquiry in the Open Studio. Mark Downey studied theoretical physics at Cambridge, and I shall speak slowly so we have time. Okay. Well, is everybody going off to do something else in the meantime? Will it take a while? Or
it'll probably take 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll just say a little bit about Mark Downey in the meantime. Okay, he studied theoretical physics at Cambridge and artificial intelligence at MIT. He's a co-founder of Open Ended Group, an independent digital art collective based in New York, whose pioneering approach to digital art frequently combines three signature elements: non-photorealistic 3D rendering, the incorporation of body movement by motion capture and other means, and the autonomy of artworks directed or assisted by artificial intelligence. Over the last 10 years, the group has worked in the broadest variety of media and venues, making art for facade. What's in the English? Facades, yeah, couldn't remember. Gallery, for dance, stage, and cinema. The group have been resident artists and researchers at institutions around the world. The field work, Art as an Inquiry in the Open Studio, will ask the question, how can art and the digital catalyze each other? And Mark Downey will talk about sightings in a series of artworks that the group has made, the engagement photography, notation, and large data sets. And the group is also feels strongly about science and engineering are becoming increasingly open source, open access, and open data. And Mark will propose that the practices of artists, scientists, and engineers have much more in common than their disciplinary boundaries and traditions might be comfortable with. So now, okay. Maybe take another minute or so. Well, for those that are thirsty, maybe we have a second to... Are you ready? Yeah, we can do that, yeah. Thanks. So, we've broken all the rules now, and we're a little bit late. Well, I think everybody needed that little break. Thanks, Mark, for that.
My apologies for the coffee break.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so imagine I'd just been introduced. I'm primarily a visual artist. I will be showing some artwork, some process behind them, and talking about the tools that I've built and the research that I've conducted into in order to help me make my artworks in order to help other people. And hopefully contextualizing it in the framework of this meeting, trying to highlight the aspects of my process and my aesthetics that has something to do with notation, that has something to do with mapping and spaces, real or imagined. The first piece I'd like to talk about is a piece that we did in 2007. It was one reason I'd like to talk about it is that it has a lot to do with notation. The other reason I'd like to talk about it is it was commissioned for Mozart's birthday. And since we're in Austria, makes sense. So Mozart was 250 in 2007. And so we got a commission to make a piece to commemorate Mozart. And it was commissioned by Lincoln Center in New York, and every year they have a Mostly Mozart Festival, which is one of the fixed stars of the New York sort of summer cultural calendar. And it takes place in that building there, Avery Fisher Hall, on Broadway. And the commission, like all of our commissions, is extremely open and sort of an occasion, do something about Mozart. So we asked the conductor of the festival, where's the meat? What's the hardest bit of Mozart? What's the challenge here? And he said, well, the last 30 or so bars of Mozart's last symphony, Symphony Number 41, Jupiter. Mozart reveals in the last moments of his last symphony that all of the thematic material that you've heard up until now in this movement fits together in a five-part vertical counterpoint. And he states the counterpoint, he does the canon, and then that's it. He's out. He's done. And if you're not paying any attention, it just sort of sounds like idiomatically correct Mozart. But it's a sort of fantastic, ridiculous stunt of composition that all of this material fits together in this elaborate jigsaw. So we build a series of computer programs to analyze the score. I am not one for classical music theory. I am one for machine learning and statistics. So instead of trying to codify the sort of knowledge of music theory from a very sort of top-down first principle approach, we came up with a very data-driven approach. So we took the data of this piece of music, carefully transcribed and digitized, and tried to build up a sort of machine learning-based idea of what was idiomatically correct. What are the rules of counterpoint based on that? So quite quickly, you get a computer program that can tease apart the last fragment of this music and say, well, this is one theme, this is another theme, and this is how they're restating. And then you can apply that analysis to sort of the piece of music as a whole and start teasing out when the themes appear and what are the permissible harmonic structures that lie underneath them when they're stated. So that work there, which took about a month or two to get a handle on, to sort of read ourselves into the statistical literature and music, started us down a course of trying to figure out how to draw music as primarily visual artists with a passionate interest and inspiration in music, but not focus on music. We started to think, well, how do we render music visible? So this was a study that we did early on in the piece, which the sorry, I'm also very quiet. So this is a series of a progression of ways of drawing a passage played by, I think, the violin. And this is the most of the last bit of the music. And at the top, you have a sort of piano roll notation that is just pitch goes outwards, time goes left, right. The next line is that piano roll notation as played by a performer. So we took each musician in the orchestra into a recording studio and recorded them playing the piece of music track by track to build up a multi-track recording and segmented that automatically to produce a set of samples that each represented the note that was played in that music. So you can stretch and deform the timing of this piece of music to draw not how it was notated, but how it's actually played at tempo and so on. But we also videotaped the performance as it was being recorded. So for every sample of audio, we also have the video clip that is that thing being played. So then you can analyze the video of that note being played. And in the case of things like violins and cellos and stringed instruments like that, you can then tease apart how the instrument is being bowed. So then you can build notations, and the last two lines are built off of that, of not just the music and the timing of the music, but the sort of physical effort and intention that goes in to playing that. So the piece that we constructed out of the sort of preparatory systems was a live, real-time, never-repeating computational cluster that was installed on the facade of Avery Fisher. And 10 computers spent 6 weeks recomposing this piece of music from scratch. So the first 30 seconds of music are literally random notes. And the piece emerges out of the dust of music. But after a short while, a sense of key emerges. Then the themes, piece by piece, are pieced together. And then the themes in relation to nearby computers are placed together. And finally, the entire piece is performed from scratch. So you end up with a sort of CD quality recording that is searched for by the computers over. It usually took the computers about anywhere between 20 and 35 minutes to put together a piece. So these are how the piece looked at the initial stage of its recomposition. Ourselves is that as the piece gets closer and closer to Mozart, more and more of the physical movement of the performers leak into the notation system. So as this video zooms into one of the screens here, you might begin to see the cello playing the notes as it moves across. And by the time the piece is complete, it looks like a, albeit abstracted, but an animated performance of the piece itself. Being sort of bowed by a violin. And the final performance sounded like this. favorite bit, where everybody sort of relaxes. So that's a piece that's very sort of dear to my heart, and it represents or touches upon techniques and an aesthetics that is present throughout my work. And one thing which I'm constantly trying to think about, one axis that I'm constantly trying to locate my work on, is an axis between the handmade, what you might call the hand and code. So something which is handcrafted, something that's written, both in an aesthetic sense, that I like to make things that look like they've been made by people, but also in a conceptual sense, that something handmade is made in a sense in one direction, that I know how to do it, and I do it with my hands, and I have a muscle memory for doing it. Whereas a code represents, it goes by many names in our form, algorithm. It's something that is a formal idea that simply it has to be executed in order to see its consequences. And you can, once you've got this axis, you can sort of play a game of trying to locate other people's work on it. You know, Photoshop probably sits quite far off to the left, and then maybe Saul LeWitt sits somewhere in the middle, and then Bridget Riley sits somewhere to the right of her. And you can give these things, these points, different names. So algorithmic is something that you might call experiential. It's something that you have to implement, experience, and then tease something out of. Because of that axis, I took a long time to sort of become comfortable self-identifying as an artist. And first I got a physics degree in order to help me understand the handmade, in order to understand the mediumness of what I was encountering. So what I find entrancing about the hand is the physics of the situation, that the charcoal pushes back, the paper pushes back. There's something uncontrollable and outside the body to that experience. To have a relationship with the algorithm that I think is artistically enjoyable, I needed to develop mechanisms of controlling computers. And that for me was, that necessitated or provoked a sort of long engagement with artificial intelligence. So AI can be seen as an attempt to get computers to do clever things, to do things when we are incapable of expressing to them an intent in their terms, in the terms that computers want, programming language, and so on. But we still want to get them to do things. So by thinking about that axis in my work, I added sort of one additional ingredient. And I'm not going to talk too much about this because I suspect that Kate, who will be speaking after me, will put this much better. But I did a series of collaborations with choreographers. And this is a diagram from Tricia Brown's notebook. Tricia Brown is an American choreographer that I'm sure most of you know about. And in the 60s and 70s, she was making these remarkable pieces, these wonderful masterpieces of dance. But she was making them, in particular, she was making them in a very fascinating way. She was constructing, in a sense, machines for producing movement. And recipes and instructions. And in this particular case, she constructed a hypothetical cube around her body with letters contained inside the cube. And then by writing sentences, by essentially writing programs for this, she would produce tasks for her to achieve. And a performance of this piece, which is Locus, is this incredible high-wire act of a human body, of physics, of the handmade, encountering a cold formal idea and surviving the encounter, and that for me had a tremendous amount to offer. I think many people who are working with the computers today, as an example. So inspired by Tricia and inspired by working with Tricia, we had a series, my group had a series of collaborations with other choreographers. One that's especially dear to my heart is a piece called Loose, which I think will speak to some of the things that Elizabeth was talking about yesterday. And Loose was a portrait of Merce Cunningham, who needs no introduction. And we took Merce into a motion capture studio in 1999, and we captured his last performance. Yeah. His knees were so shot through from performing in the unsprung floors of American gymnasia that the only dance that he could do in 99 was a dance for his hands. So our motion capture studio gratefully reconfigured their mocap studio to capture just this volume. And at the time, he was rehearsing this piece because he was performing it as an encore to a play. And we captured it, and we put it in a bag. And we made an installation, and we made a real-time system that takes the motion capture data and is continuing.
February 20th, 1937, Saturday. 4-hour train trip, 1:30 to 5:30. Taxi ride from Macy's, 36th Street, up to 50th Street, through my first glimpse of the Great White Way. Victoria filled up. Finally park at Hotel Chesterfield. Dump of the first water.
In almost exactly the same way as Michael described. Merce's voice, him reading from his diary of his first visit to New York, is propelled mathematically into a set of John Cage prepared piano samples. And the intonations of his speech end up played back by the piano. Visually, the piece is constructed used by architecting a colony of autonomous creatures that track the motion capture points. So there are 44 points of motion, 22 on each hand. There are 44 autonomous little things that moved with the data and then took decisions about how to appear, what other points to connect to, and what signals to send out into the environment. The result was a real-time system that myself and my collaborators could all sit in front of and express our preferences. So once again, you have this sort of code-like system that has its own rules and its own formal properties and it's a formal idea that you have in the shower in the morning one day. And then you implement it. And then your job as an artist is sort of survive the encounter with this formal system and tease out the potential that is latent and hidden in it. And that's the game. As we were moving along with both the music and the visuals, we found at that time, when we made this piece for the first time, which was in 2001, that we started producing scores, that even amongst three people working intensely on a single piece, we needed recourse to additional notational strategies just to keep a handle on the larger scale dramaturgy of this piece. And at that time, in the initial version of this piece, those scores were made by hand. But then as time went on, we realized that there was a tremendous opportunity to make those scores executable, make those scores actionable. And the desire to be able to score on a computer, to score code, resulted in a series of investigations into what tools we can have to write code on computers. The last ingredient, before I really focus on tools for a bit, the last ingredient is a rejection of motion capture that we developed a year ago or a year and a half ago. We got very tired of motion capture after a while. We were sort of in danger of becoming the motion capture group. What's fun about motion capture is that it gives you this incredibly clean, high-resolution motion, these points of motion. And everything else, the musculature, the clothing, the breath, the sweat, just disappears. So the look of dance disappears, and all it is motion. And you can go through a phase where you're quite bored about the look of dance, and motion is very exciting. And then as a visual person, the job of drawing bodies is something that's quite intoxicating. But after a while, you miss the sweat, you miss the effort, you miss the breath, the muscles. So last year, we developed a system for capturing the exact opposite of motion capture, capturing the surface, the volume, the mass of dance. And we got ourselves commissioned by the Hayward Gallery in London last year to collaborate with British choreographer Wayne McGregor, who we have a long series of ongoing projects of various kinds with. And I don't know if we pissed somebody off at the gallery or what, but the only space they'd give us was the stairwell. I don't know if, how many of you have been in the Hayward, but there's this tremendous, fantastic, hideous, shuttered concrete stairwell in the middle of it. So we took the challenge and we shot the material for this piece, which was a series of improvisations by Wayne. We shot it in the space itself. And I developed a three-camera capture system that, by carefully calibrating the positions of the cameras, you could capture the surface geometry of the scene in such a way that the computer could begin to try to tease apart the difference between figure and ground. And the visuals for this piece, which again ended up as a piece of stereoscopic cinema, came out of this constant attempt by the computer to figure out what was dancer and what was architecture. And the capture rig, camera system that we constructed, enabled me to get incredibly close to this performer. And I got whacked on the head a couple of times, which satisfied my desire to sort of capture the sweat of dance. And it was installed initially in the stairwell itself on three stereoscopic screens. So one of the things that indicated to us that we could do was to have a sort of serious investigation, not just of dance, which is something we're fairly well known for doing, but architecture, that we could go to a space and somehow grab hold of that in much the same way as we grabbed hold of Mozart and grabbed hold of a motion capture performance. So in order to sort of survive the code aspects of these pieces. And in order to survive several pieces that we made in the theater, which is a very demanding situation. A long time before I even started my group as a PhD student, I started constructing my own tools for writing code. And for the Loops piece, in one of its incarnations about 2005, we got terribly concerned about the legacy of our work because, you know, we're egotistical artists, but also the legacy of Merce Cunningham. And we had in our possession this sort of ridiculous artifact. We had his last performance. It's the only dance of his that he choreographed. He initially made it in the late 60s. It's the only dance he did that he never set on anyone else. So there's no recourse to the muscle memory of some random dancer. This is it. It's just going to die. So the Mellon Foundation at the time was very interested in preservation of artwork. And they commissioned a project by which we attempted to preserve our portrait of Merce Cunningham and the underlying date. So we used that as an excuse to do a couple of things. We used that as an excuse to open source an artwork, which is something that we've never done before. Open source all of the tools that we constructed to make that artwork, which initiated a project called Field. And we, in collaboration with Merce, we got him to open source his performance. So there is on our website a Merce Cunningham motion capture performance, which you can use for non-commercial. It's a Creative Commons license, the attribution non-commercial. And a few years back, a museum actually commissioned a series of remixes of our piece, and which is an interesting, I mean, it speaks directly to what you were talking to. Yes, I mean, what do you leave behind for reinterpretation? And so five fairly notable media artists remixed our work sort of in front of us in a way that was absolutely terrifying. I don't think I'll ever do again. So it's probably better to be dead before you get remixed. I was one of the most profoundly unsatisfying experiences in my career. But what has been satisfying has been open sourcing the tools and the encounter that I've had with other artists as they pick up my ideas and start to use them has been tremendously wonderful. So this is a screenshot from this from a programming environment called Field that is now a sort of an autonomous project that we started. And Field is a very sort of chameleon, chimeric kind of environment. It's a code writing environment for sure. It's a scripting environment. It likes you to write Python. But there's an additional window. There's an additional canvas. And in that canvas, you can make ad hoc notational systems that explore, keep track of, help you debug the code that you're writing. And so this is a slightly sped up video of some of the drawing support there is in Field. And the code on the right, for the people who can code, I think the survey that Tim did was about 50-50. The code on the right produces a bunch of lines which go in the window on the left. What's interesting and perhaps different is that the lines on the left-hand side can be edited with the mouse, just as if it was Adobe Illustrator or something. More interesting than that, though, is that the code on the right can still affect the lines that you have edited with the mouse. And no representation code or sort of handmade wins. These two ways of editing and manipulating and creating are constantly being merged together. And this this approach, this idea that you can have multiple accesses onto a set a data or an editing task is something which is echoed throughout the environment. So as obviously this is a tool that many people are excited about. Architects particularly think that this is a very interesting take on parametric modeling, for example. But the ultimate goal is not to produce a sort of competitor for Adobe Illustrator or something, or a competitor for any particular product. The ultimate goal is to rethink what a product is. And the previous screenshot that I showed was, in a sense, an environment that I constructed in this environment for making a particular piece. It was a feature-length experimental film that had a score written by somebody else. So suddenly you have a problem of how do you keep track of a very, very large project where there needs to be a number of places which has material that aligns with music. So in that sense, you suddenly need an environment that can consume large quantities of music, maybe bits of notation here or there, and allow you to align bits of code and snippets and keyframes and various things to it. And you think about how to patch this together with sort of conventional tools, and you go through the contents of your hard drive, and you find what you might call in the context of this conference, you find a set of notational strategies embodied in products. And so on my hard drive right now, there are these things, and they're all timelines. So Maya, Color, Flash, Logic, these all have their own timelines. This duplication, this redundancy is the... it's offensive to me as an engineer that you have all of these things redone that are the same. But it's also problematic as a working artist that you have all of these representations that have two problems. One is that they are not very interesting. I mean, there is not wide range of them. Right? They're all the same idea. And they're all rather balkanized. None of them really want to talk to each other. So you need a large project, a 60-minute offer or something. None of these products really want to talk to each other. And you can do a similar thing with these kinds of representations. These are data flow systems. And again, on my hard drive right now, I have like a dozen of these. And this is problematic because it's boring. None of them want to talk to each other. So what is the tool, what is the environment where you can do two things? You can consume these products whole, like a snake eating an egg, in order to force them to integrate. How can you inject code into these environments? And secondly, what environment do you need in order to make your own ad hoc notational paradigms for writing code and exploring these things? So Field is in a position where you can obviously talk to MaxMSP, and you can talk to processes, and you can talk to these environments, but you can also duplicate parts of them. There's enough drawing, enough graphics, enough notation that you can, if you decide, oh, I need a data flow paradigm for this thing, you can just hack one together. And if you need a timeline that does something particularly funky, you can have a timeline that does something particularly funky. So the sense of product, the sense of feature, begins to dissolve, and in a way that I think is fascinating and interesting and complementary to the fantastically popular and fantastically productive things like processing or open frameworks or LibCinder and so on. So given the tune that I heard, I think I will stop there and take questions.
I suggest 10 minutes for questions. Who wants to start? Anyone? Yeah?
So this communication tool between all these different types of programs, it's existing or not? I didn't understand it. Yeah? It's existing. Okay. So I can download and
the key warning is that when you sort of dissolve the idea of a product away, you also dissolve dissolve its usefulness, right? So people say, well, what does your environment do? I mean, like, what are its features? And it doesn't do a damn thing, right? There, you download it and it sits there and it's got the emptiest empty window you can imagine. It's a text editor for writing code that is idiosyncratic and weird and extensible and graphical, but it doesn't actually do anything. So it's an invitation to write code, and it's an invitation to stitch these things together. But it's not a sort of feature-laden product.
So what kind of knowledge do I need to use this tool?
You need to be able to program in a programming language, preferably Python.
Python. So I do need...
Yeah.
To write Python.
You know, we're quite language agnostic and quite language, we're quite easily excitable by languages. So, you know, you can do Clojure or Scala or various other oddball things. But it's definitely a programming environment.
Okay.
I got it. Anyone else?
Because you stopped earlier, but
How
would it go? I was like, don't stop. That was the question.
You'll never know. You know what you get if you give me that
comment. Maybe the follow-up question to Elizabeth is, how many or are any other people using Field?
Yes, which is kind of terrifying and exciting.
Have they, what sort of surprising, then the interesting question, what sort of surprising things have they done with it that you didn't expect?
One thing which I didn't expect
I mean, first of all, I mean, there are people like making 2D prints and stuff in it, which is extremely weird, and a lot of people doing like offline video editing. Like, really, I think there are actually a community of people who are really upset about video editing and are desperate for tools. Their architecture community is upset about their tools. I mean, so if you have the parametric architects, people who make funky, curvy structures, it's a horrible characterization of the school of architecture, but funky, curvy architects, they really do feel extremely hemmed in by their tools, because there's a seriousness about architecture, that the pipes have to go through the floor and the wall sockets have to line up, that cuts across sort of more experimental form generation system. So architects, they turn out, is one of the sites where they really get hurt by their tools not being very interesting. And they really feel the envelope that they're pushing. And then the other exciting thing which is happening right now is that there's a movement right now in science that people feel like science is changing. The science is being dragged somewhere, or parts of science is being dragged somewhere, perhaps against its will, by data. So science, as it's supposed to be practiced, is that scientists has a hypothesis, designs an experiment to go collect it, collects just that data, carefully controlled, and then analyzes the data and sees its hypothesis. Now, there are these phenomenally gigantic data sets that are being captured by scientists. And they're like, what is in here? Something. And this kind of inductive science means that they end up in a position much more like an artist sitting in front of a computer. So they have some material that they're fairly certain has some incredible potential in it. And they have a set of algorithms that today, increasingly, they did not write, that they want to apply to this material and see if they can tease out the potential that's latent in it. So we're getting a lot of interest from scientists who have sort of let MATLAB in their practice run to its logical conclusion and just can't handle any more MATLAB. And there's a climate scientist in Georgia Tech who's using Field, for example, because, first of all, he has to work this way. He has to work inductively with these gigantic climate models. And secondly, there's a movement in climate science to make your investigations of these data sets very transparent. So there's a goal to make them sort of visual, understandable, transparent. So there are moves like that afoot, which is very surprising.
I guess I wanted to ask a little bit about the relationship between dance and technology, because I think you've got a kind of good take on it. It's a pretty open question. I mean, with dancers, they are often seeing their bodies, I guess, as a kind of tool to some extent, and the relationship between a kind of computer or an abstraction of dance, you know, this can be a really long distance often, at least in my experience of those collaborations. So I'm interested to kind of hear how these collaborations go with various people.
Yeah. Let's see if I've got anything to say about that, Bill. One of the things that we've had the privilege of doing is we have a trilogy of portraits that are strictly made in the following sense. We, by accident or luck or persuasion, persuaded a person who's better known as a choreographer to dance for us. We captured that and then ran off and made a piece with it. So that's a collaboration but of sorts, right? And because we take it and then we stir it, right? And sometimes it's mocap, and sometimes it's very creative not to capture certain stuff. But that's very much on our territory. So then we make the cinema or a piece of installation with it. If they like what we do, we get invited back into their world. So we have done a couple of stage pieces. And we did a piece called Foot Canvas, which is utterly not famous at all.
what happens there is that we two things. We approach it mainly as a visual artist, as a sort of specialist in the body. And we exploit the real timeness of our tools in order to be able to work in the theater. So the initial sort of threat of why I ended up as a toolmaker came from working with Trisha Brown in the theater. And I could see that she had it. I initially said yes, because I knew that she had some tactical form of mind. And I wanted to see how the sort of dad's art computer can play out in front of my eyes. And what I realized was that her computers were much more reconfigurable than mine. Because she could turn a dance on his head with a single sentence to her supernaturally talented dance. When I'm sitting here typing away, writing Java in Eclipse. And I said, well, I either need to stop collaborating, prepare myself off site, and then just let it see if it works, or I need to completely change. So that's not a very dance answer to your question, because I'm not a very dance. You just have to deal with it because it is the opportunity. I mean, that's what it is.
I will follow up his question. Are you interested in dancing diagrams?
Am I interested in dancing diagrams? Yes, I'm actually fascinated by I'm fascinated by all notational strategies in dance. Every so often, I'll encounter someone who is obsessed by one of them. So you'll come across some sort of Laban head who thinks that they have like the one notational strategy. And all of the choreographers that I love, is this true? Yeah, all of the choreographers I love have fantastic notebooks, right? And their notational strategies are taken incredibly seriously by them, usually for the length of one piece, and then are abandoned, and some other incredible notational strategy is taken very seriously for one piece. So, and the same is true with the formal systems that govern our pieces. I mean, once we've developed a certain sort of confidence and rapport with their texture, they are given. There's a sense of purity about that, because there's a sense that the piece will be better if you mine out something from that moment as opposed to start stuff together. So we take those things very, very, very seriously, and then abandon it at the end of the piece and do something. So with that warning, yes.
Yeah, I have a kind of an open question. I found very interesting that you said you use like an artificial life element for generating some of the visuals for your pieces. And I'm curious, like, how is it to work with this AI life or AI intelligence as a kind of method or a tool or material for creating a visual for a piece? Because I feel like that, you know, you have this element of not having complete control of it. And is it like that, for example, the music or the dance inspires you, okay, I set my L system parameters like that because of that tune, or I don't know, how does that work? Like,
well, so, yeah, I mean, it's all about control, right? I mean, art is about control. And there was especially when I was growing up, maybe in the kind of early 90s, there was a real rhetoric around emergence. And sort of the new math, and that kind of cross-pollinated into art in quite a big way. And there were all these sort of people saying, "Well, I'm working emergently. You know, I'm making these complicated systems. I don't really know what I'm doing. Something's going to emerge." And the great danger with being that uncontrolled is the following: when something really fantastic happens, you then can't take advantage of it. And so you're then left with the question, and I think this is one of the questions, is what formal systems are unpredictable enough so that they can surprise me and reward me and can give something back, but are controllable enough so that I can take advantage of those surprises and control them back into the piece. And there's a set of techniques from AI which I think offer a set of answers. So there are not artificial lives, but artificial agents that are trainable, for example, where you can say more of that and don't ever do that again. That's a huge line of thought for AI, which is, you know, reward structures for intelligent creatures. And then obviously, in sort of a less pure AI kind of way, there are machine learning techniques for sort of capturing presence in that data. So that's where that type of practice is why AI is sort of important to what I do. So the fact that Luke was structured as calling it creatures leaks a little bit into the aesthetic of the piece, compared to the piece that's kind of slightly insect-like, but isn't the point. I'm only talking about it. We're talking about both. But it is a very interesting way of structuring the piece. It's a thing you can have you and your collaborators sit around a running piece, say that, there, yeah, that's good. That never happens again. Right? And so you can begin to express your preferences over this very complicated system. And those preferences get fully.
Is that what you used for the Mozart piece, for enlightenment?
Yeah, I mean, in a less sort of AI, more machine learning kind of way. So you set apart the task as like saying, what is counterpoint? And so you learn it instead of writing it down.
I think my suggestion is that we should have something to eat. Thanks very much. Unless there's a pressing question, I mean, there's always a chance to informally ask Mark about his work. Thank you very much. So it's not an hour. I'll suggest that back at 2 o'clock. Yes, we will punctual this time.
Re-punctualize us.
So another tool to learn. Another toy to learn.
Okay, welcome back after lunch. We will continue with another 3 presentations this afternoon. The next one will be from Kate Sikyo. She's going to talk about hacking choreography. And Kate Sikyo is a choreographer, media artist, and performer. Her work includes dance performances, web and video projects. Internationally present, she researches Her research has been published. She researches also into the field of dance, and she's currently finished her PhD at the University of East London and is currently a senior lecturer in dance at the University of Lincoln in the UK. And Hacking Choreography explores both the overlap of programming and coding languages and choreography, as well as principles of computer hacking, such as reproposing or subverting. The ongoing aims of the research is to continue to find the similarities between code and choreography, and as well as to find if this may... implications in areas such as live notation or live coding. My question would be, hacking in what respect?
Yeah, I think it's just the idea of how to change something and repurpose it. Yeah, it's about change. I think that will become clearer.
Okay. Well,
I'm not actually hacking up bodies.
I just wanted to, just before you start, I wanted to mention there is an audio sort of setup for everybody who's been here and been a speaker. It's like a sort of a little statement about being here and their work. If everybody could post that little message at the back there, if you have any question, ask Tim. He can show you where it is and what is required. Okay.
Right. Hello, and thank you for having me. So I'm going to talk about hacking choreography and what that means in my practice. So I'm a choreographer, and most of my work involves real-time video projection and live performance, which I program as well as choreograph and usually perform in. So I sort of create all the elements of the pieces. And this project sort of came out of how in my head I don't separate those things. They're all choreography to me. Like, actually sitting and coding is choreography to me. So this sort of developed out of that sort of idea of how does this code become choreography. So one of the first things in order to sort of get your head around this idea of choreography as being programming is you need to start by expanding the definition of choreography. And one of the main things is separating dance and choreography. They're two actually distinct things. So sort of historically, like when we talk about dance and dance analysis systems and notation systems, a lot of it starts with Laban. And he has different principles, choreectric principles of the kinesphere, or his notation, kinetology, kinegraphy. But all of his systems and ways of discussing dance revolve around the body. The kinesphere, because I'm particularly interested in movement in space, the kinesphere is just the reach around the body. He didn't have a way of notating or describing what he called the general space of performance. He really focused on the body. So as sort of dance discourse developed, Preston Dunlap and Anna Sanchez-Kohlberg sort of, they really started to look at choreography as, they called it the nexus of the strands of the dance medium. But they really started to look sort of beyond just the body sort of making these movements and defined choreography as these relationships between four strands, which was performer, choreographer, sound, and space. So the whole idea is the choreography is the moment when these things have an interrelationship. So that becomes much more interesting in a way. And that sort of more recently has been developed even a bit further. One of the projects that really does that is William Forsythe's Choreographic Objects, in which they've sort of taken his dance score and reproduced it in several different mediums. So it's removed sort of the body aspect from the choreography and said, okay, what else can become the performer in the choreography? And then other people, such as Martin Spangberg in his book, Spenbergism, he does the same thing. He says dance and choreography are completely separate. And his book started as a blog, which he said the blog was a choreography. And his whole approach to this blog, which he did at a dance festival, was to set it up as if it was a choreographic practice in the process of writing. So he's like, okay, I'm going to do this for so many hours a day, as if I was going in the studio with so many dancers. And so he wrote as a choreography. And then another choreographer who's doing a similar thing is Siobhan Davies in the UK. She's sort of come up with these different choreographic patterns and then given them to particularly craftspeople, like people doing ceramics, and had them make a ceramics that she presented as choreography as part of a project. So this idea that once we remove sort of the body from talking about choreography, we have a lot more potential of what can become choreography. So that's really interesting. However, even though I'm saying we're removing the body, we're not quite removing it. So I really like this is one of Forsyth's sort of definitions of a choreographic object. He says, the choreographic object is not a substitute for a body, but rather an alternative site for the understanding of the potential instigation and organization of action to reside. So that's really important, that we're not actually substituting the body. We're not saying, oh, we don't need it. There's still a relationship between the body and the choreography, but it's not centered around that anymore, like Laban's work. It's become just, we've sort of moved the focus away from the body in a little bit. He continues saying, ideally, choreographic ideas in this form would draw an attentive, diverse readership that would eventually understand and hopefully champion the innumerable manifestations, old and new, of choreographic thinking. So he really proposes that choreography is a way of thinking. And that's another thing I'm really interested in. However, one thing I don't necessarily... Well, he uses the word organization, and I prefer the word relationship. I think of choreography as relationships rather than organization. So that this is a lot of heavy terms that I'm not going to have time to unpack, but one of the things that I find is in Deleuze and Guattari is this plane of organization or plane of composition, which is about these ideas of interrelationships is what makes a composition. So in a sense, the plane of composition is very similar to how I'm defining choreography. And then once you've sort of moved away from the body, you can also go into sort of new territories of space. So that's actually what I did in my PhD. So this word choreotopology was I actually looked at how choreography could create non-Euclidean spaces and how topology could be used to describe actually my choreographic practice where there's a dancer in a physical space, but then the camera is translating that, and then it's in a projection, but it's in its overall composition within a live performance, all happening simultaneously. So I decided the relationship of that was topological, and the choreography of that is choreotopology. But then another sort of manifestation of this idea of separating choreography and dance, and through that practice, became the code, became the choreography as well. So this isn't necessarily a new thing, and there's lots of different approaches to this idea this idea of sort of computational elements within performance. You can find this in the work of Merce Cunningham. A lot of the Judson Dance Theater, such as Tricia Brown, have these sort of elements. Another person is William Forsythe, who... I think it's Alien Action is a piece that's actually all created via algorithms and then danced. And then other people have explored this in things like Scott Dillahunty did a project called Software for Dancers in 2001, which had some mixed results, I would say. Some of my friends who were on that project said basically it was sort of before its time. and then also... I've sort of gotten involved in the world of live coding a bit now, which I'll explain in a little bit, how my work sort of overlaps with live coding. but Nick Collins is a live coder who's been doing live coding without computing or computers, and a lot of that is basically scores for dancers, even though he doesn't sort of realize that yet. He's definitely a performance artist trapped in a live coder's body. So this is actually an example from the software for dancers project. And this sort of really inspired one of my pieces that I'm going to show. So this is the code for the ballet movement, a Gleeside. So all of this code is for this one step. That's it. So they really did a complex sort of defining their terms. And it even says, like, they're not using arms. They wanted to do a glissade assemblé, which has one little extra jump at the end, and they never got to the assemblé. but they're defining fifth position. They're defining the plié you start in. They're defining that you brush one leg, then brush the other, then land in the fifth. So, yeah, this is one sort of interesting way that sort of code and choreography has overlapped. Within my own work, I really wanted to find a way that I could do something similar to that with scores and how I could start to change them, but in real time. Because one of the things I was doing with sort of my video tracking systems was I hacked a Kinect, right? And so I got really interested in this idea, okay, so I've hacked the video system. What happens when I hack sort of the movement system? So I started with existing scores and then decided, okay, I'm going to take this as the code and then somehow change this to make the performance. So this is the first hack I started with. And originally I asked a friend, a dance artist in Canada, to make me a score, and she's like, well, actually, all of my scores are just adaptations from the Fluxus workbook. So just go there. So that's what I did. And I picked out this score because in a lot of ways it reminded me of like computer programming in that you like at the top it defines sort of all the variables of the performance, and then it has a running order. So in a way that became sort of a place to start. So I have a video of me performing this hack. So this is a really sort of informal experiment I did at the university I work at. So in this particular score, you label a bunch of objects. And so I created my labels out of pieces of paper and paper stickers. And the first part is I follow the score as I would interpret it without trying to hack it. So that's what this part is, me just organizing objects that have been labeled into categories that are sort of on pieces of paper on the floor. Part of the score says you can use audience members as objects, so I did that. I think the other thing that's important is I did this with very little preparation. So the idea was that the composition would emerge in real time. I didn't rehearse this. I just sort of planned out the elements and then did it. And part of that was because I wanted the hack to really be in real time. Although, in a way, I just went in and had no idea what I was going to do to hack this piece. Because the other thing is I chose a piece where sort of all the possibilities in the running order are exhaustive, right? There's nothing else you can do with the categories given. So I wanted to figure out how I could do that in a real pressurized situation. Thank you. So the initial way I decided to hack it was I actually started ripping up the paper in the categories. So instead of like everything I had, or nothing, I had no and thing. And so I was making new categories out of the sort of like language that existed. And I sort of ended the piece just because I was getting frustrated with not knowing if I, what I had done. And yeah, I was sort of really struggling with this, trying to make these decisions in real time. And I was like, kind of just get fed up with it. And that's when the performance ended. I just wheeled everything off stage. So then the next choreographic hack I made was I sort of made my own code. So it's kind of like the Glee slide code, but it's actually made to look like maybe Java, JavaScript, or something like that. But actually, it has, it's also made so a dancer could read it. That's sort of the point. So I sort of have my setup with my two dancers. I defined movement that I was interested in. And they're in very sort of vague terms, so the dancers had to interpret this and make sense of this. And then I sort of, the choreography section is sort of the relationships created, because again, I'm thinking of choreography as relational. And then I gave them sort of an order to run it in. And so I gave this to two of my students to learn the day before the performance without any other instructions. I just gave them this. So they had to sort of figure out what these movements meant, what it means to rotate, what it means to brush, and then also what it meant to rotate 120 when someone else is jumping, that kind of thing. And then about halfway through the performance, I put up new instructions. That was the hack, that they had to somehow adjust their relationship based on this new instruction. I did give this them the hack like an hour before we actually performed it. So they knew it was coming and they knew what it was, but they still had to figure it out sort of in the moment. So the order they performed this in was first they just performed the movements straight through. Then they performed it with the relationship. And then they performed the hack when it appeared on the screen before. So one of my colleagues in the computer science department got really excited about this, so he wrote it up as it was if in real in JavaScript as opposed to my dance language, and it is really incredibly similar. Whether I think I'd probably, if I had given this to the dancers, they probably still would have figured it out, I think. But yeah, it was really similar to my sort of fake language. And then sort of the last, initially I did these three hacks, and the last one actually became about the dancer as a hacker. And I gave verbal instructions. And I'll let you watch this one first, and then I'll talk about it.
Right foot, lift left hand, execute. Lunge left, curve right arm, look at right hand. Execute. Run three times, step, brush leg and hop, put arms back and up twice. Execute. Lie down on stomach, lift head, turn head right and left three times. Rotate shoulders twice, turn head right and left three times. Execute. Jump, reach arm up, step right left, turn, run four times, jump, reach arms up. Execute. Lift left knee, bring right elbow to knee, release, kneel to ground. Execute. Step back into a lunge to the floor. Circle the right wrist four times. Execute. Step right and left. Flex the left foot. Clasp the hands above the head. Jump three times. Extend the right leg. Bend the right knee. Extend the right knee. Flex the right foot. Point the right foot. Execute. Arms reach overhead, hop on left foot twice, turn four times, kneel, reach left, arm up to the right, turn head left, execute. Rotate shoulders, stand on head, run three times, jump 11 times, execute. Lie down, lift head, turn shoulders, look right and left, reach arms up, circle three times, execute. Lift left knee, bring right elbow to knee, skip towards the back, execute. Raise the right hand, lift the left foot, execute. First leg and hop, swing arms back, execute. Stand on right foot, lift left arm, end.
So what becomes interesting in that one is the score isn't actually what I'm saying. Well, it starts with what I'm saying, and then she has to slowly sort of slowly change what she's doing so it's not what I'm saying. And so it starts with just like the moment she lies on her back instead of her stomach. And there's like moments when she does that until the end, she's just completely ignoring me and has nothing to do with what I'm saying. She's just completely doing her own thing. So the score isn't what I'm saying at all, only in the very like first three. So she's the one hacking the score in that case. So a lot these experiments sort of led me to this community of live coders. Because what I found that I have in common with them is these live compositional processes, in that there's some sort of system or score or composition or tool that's set up, and then within that there's a sort of frame for changing stuff. But there's also a transparency about it, with the projecting of the code, or sort of like with the execute piece, you sort of understand like she's ignoring me by the end, and it's kind of funny. So those things sort of led me to work with some live coders. So I worked with Alex McLean on a piece we did. It wasn't very successful for a lot of reasons, so we're hoping to do it again. But these are some stills from the documentation. And what we were trying to do was build a feedback loop between us. So I would do, I had sort of set movements that I had sort of pre-coded and were protected behind me. And he had his system that, well, it wasn't, this was part of the problem. It wasn't the system he was supposed to use for this performance, but it's a whole other story. But so we had a system that was being projected. And the idea was I actually changed different dynamics and qualities of the movement while I was performing. And then he would change different dynamics and qualities of the sound he was producing based on that. But then when I heard the changes, I would then change my qualities and dynamics based on the new sound. And so we were trying to create this feedback loop that way. And we had both our codes sort of projected side by side. Yeah, and we're hoping to do it again, and actually he can have the right system working. And also, we didn't rehearse beforehand, so we had no idea, actually, if we could feedback from each other. And most of my choreography doesn't use sound. So so for me, that was actually a really big challenge, was to listen to sound and react to sound. Because even though this is that separating of choreography and dance. Dance a lot of times does have sort of musical accompaniment, but choreography doesn't necessarily have that. So I usually don't work with sound. So yeah, I think we will revisit this in a more rehearsed manner. But there is still this idea of there's a score, but it's this live compositional process is what's the priority. So doing a couple more choreographic hacks. So in Bristol at the Arnolfini, I'm doing a piece. I'm part of so there's this live notation group that's looking at where live code and live art sort of meet. And so I'm actually considered one of the live coders on the project, not one of the live artists, which is really interesting. So one of the projects I'm doing is some of the artists are going to draw me a score, and I have to dance that as they're drawing it live. And so they can either and then another artist can come and either draw over that or smudge it or erase it or whatever, and I have to respond to that by moving in the space. So they're creating the map in real time, and I'm following the map in real time. And then Trio A is a piece by Von Rainier that I've kind of hacked before thinking about it. But it's a really specific 4-minute piece with really specific parameters that she's actually written this sort of essay that compares it to minimalist sculpture. And I have done a piece where I've sort of used her parameters before to create a choreography. And I've learned Trio A from Yvonne. I've worked with her. So I'm interested to find new ways to hack Trio A, because in a way, Trio A is a hack of choreography, because it does have all these like interesting parameters anyways. So yeah, I think that's hacking choreography.
Any questions? Anyone? No. About timing. Mm. Because I guess it's... if you have to read, there is a gap in between the action, because you need this time to read. How do you deal with that?
I let the gap be there. I think the gap's interesting, and it's that computational moment where like the dancer has to negotiate these things, and I think that's an interesting tension.
And the second, which goes somehow with this, is the body memory, because actually you are out of this body memory. If you continuously have this kind of new stuff, you know, coming, so this how, I mean, how does it feel like?
Yeah, it's scary. Yeah, because you can't rely on what you've rehearsed. yeah, you have to just say, okay, this is it, and that's what it's going to be. So it is, you have to give up a lot of control. Yeah, and that's really difficult as a dancer because, you train in these techniques, so you have all this control. And as a choreographer, also a lot of it is about, like, all the sort of traditional ways of notating dance are all about where you place the body in these precise ways. And that, and as a choreographer notating this way, you're sort of giving up all of that. So, yeah, it's scary. It's one of the reasons why I do it, I think, because I am a bit of a control freak, so it forces me to give up that.
I was just wondering why you very much concentrated on sort of textual description, because there wasn't any diagrams at all, which I thought was interesting. You're talking about, and you're not really talking about space, it's all about movements, and the spatial stuff sort of emerges out of that.
Yeah. I mean, that comes out of the topology a little bit, is that movement defines space, and it's the movement that makes the space. However, there is still, the frame of the black box in the case of that. And I think the diagram stuff is coming, like with the drawing thing. That's the next one. Because I am very interested in that as well. How do you actually represent this in other ways besides the textual?
There was a very exciting moment with the two dancers when they went into the hack and they suddenly had to start paying attention to each other. What happens when you multiply the number of dancers on the stage, each with different instructions?
Yeah, I want to do that. I haven't done that yet. I think that will be, really important, because then they have to, totally realize their relationships, not just the relationship of the movement in their own body. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few companies in Melbourne where I'm from that are working with, I think they would call it instruction-based improvisation, and I'm wondering, like, how you'd, or if it's just a kind of neat way to say the same thing by calling it hacking choreography, like how you delineate between hacking and kind of instructional improvisation, or kind of this.
Is there
a difference between the two?
I think so. I think that in dance, there's a lot of improvisation that has a score or an underscore, we call it a lot of times. And it's this driving thing that you know is going to happen throughout the piece, even though the movement's improvisational. And a lot of those scores, you decide on it beforehand and then you go and perform it, kind of thing. And so the movement or where you're doing the movement or your relationship is improvised. But I think what changes in this is that then there's this sort of real-time change of that score. And that's the hack, is that it's something that it necessarily wasn't in the initial score that you set out to perform or improvise to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that that sometimes just, like, I've seen some really interesting works where members of the audience are invited up, like, on stage with people who are performing, and they put on headphones, and, like, this has the instructions for what they're doing, so they're receiving it for the first time and having to perform. And also I've seen some performances recently with, like, mobile phones that all the dancers are wearing with an earpiece, and the other performers are calling them and telling them what to do, which is quite nice, like, quite similar, although I don't know whether, I guess my question is about whether hacking, like, actually, you know, because for me, like, there's hacking, like, there's the hack, which is, like, the kind of, you know, glamorous, anonymous, or there's just, like, hacking at something, which is just to work at it a lot and to do it without knowing what you're doing beforehand, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that there's also a choreographer who uses an app and gets audience feedback on the app, and the dancers respond to the app, yeah.
But I think one of the other differences between that, there's a huge tradition of sort of problem-solving and task-based creation of choreography, in addition to yours being real-time, is that you have a commitment to showing the code, right? And that's, you know, I make real-time visual systems, and I'm not a live coder because I don't show my code. Right? I haven't signed on to the sort of manifesto of having the code overlay the imagery. So my real question is, what do you think you get from that, from your commitment to having the, you know, the, in this case, Ted, just hanging out behind the dancer?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just the pragmatic thing of they need to see it. I mean, I could put it on monitors and face them so the audience doesn't see it. But I think there's something about them, the audience sort of being in on the joke that it's this, you know, fake Java language. and I think that adds, yeah, sort of an interesting layer to the piece where that sort of part of my process wouldn't be seen necessarily otherwise.
The build for site, the other overwhelming number of choreographers don't commit to improvisation, use that to then produce material that they then edit down into fixed pieces. And so one question to you is if you cast this net out, you see two dancers performing the piece, and they do something that's fantastic. You might never see that again.
Yeah, I think that, and that's also...
You're over that?
Yeah, and I think that's also part of an interesting thing with overlap with the live coders. A lot of them are like, we don't save our code after a show, we throw it away, because that moment will never happen again like that, so why bother trying to recreate it? So I kind of, in this project, am subscribing to that as well, yeah. Yeah, like, can I ever actually recreate that wonderful moment again in a live performance, or... should I just say that was awesome and live with that moment that I had?
I'm just curious about this because when you project the text and you generate it, but as an audience, how much I'm busy with reading the text, looking at the dancer and figuring out their mode of interpretation and if it's right, wrong?
Yeah, I mean, that was... with the projected text, that was probably the main feedback I got was actually they could have kept doing that same initial loop of just the movements for much longer, so they could have made that connection before the hack came in. So, yeah, that would be my revision, is to keep the initial movement on longer so the audience learns it.
And ask them to repeat it.
The dancers, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting because in that sense you were talking about doing it live or whatever, but it's become obviously a script. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a tension there that I'm just curious, who is solving the tension? Is it the dancer or is the viewer in that sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure yet, yeah. But yeah, that tension is there, yeah. Mm.
I was just wondering where your intention is to go with this. Where your intention is to go with this further.
Yeah, I'd like to have sort of an evening of 20 choreographic hacks and sort of present that as sort of a final show kind of thing. But I've been just sort of slowly developing the hacks. And sort of played with these three initial ones and now... finding new places to go, or things like the one with Alex, I think could, because it was much longer as well than the other ones. It was like a almost 20 minute long piece that probably could stand on its own as something different, and also because that uses sound and that's really different from my other practice. So I feel like that one might be separate and developed into something else. But yeah, I'd like to have sort of 20 of these little things in an evening. Mm-hmm. 20 is just an arbitrary number, but it sounds good.
Anybody else? Question? Tim?
I think you sort of touched on this, that with the you're referring to someone, all their work was based on somehow taking this Fluxus workbook and using that as a basis from which they derived a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of made me think back to Elizabeth's comments yesterday about having a body of work that's in there that is actually being picked up and reinterpreted and in some sense hacked by people using it now with, I don't know, taking old Stockhausen pieces and replaying them with modern instruments or whatever. That mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff just gets lost. I mean, is in some sense the whole sort of Fluxus instruction-based art pieces, is that the total precursor of this?
No, it definitely is a precursor. I mean, because there's also, I think that's one trajectory that's sort of led me to this, is this idea of like these performance pieces where they sort of, yeah, have the score roll up, do it. And it's working with the live artists in this live notation project, that's sort of what they do. They don't necessarily rehearse. They have this idea and they refine the idea and then they do it in the space on the day. That's how a lot of them that I'm working with do work. So that's one sort of influence. But the more choreographic tradition is less about, yeah, sort of how it goes on the day. It is about rehearsing and usually refining the material, taking what you want out of those sort of scores and improvisations. So it's another part is sort of, yeah, taking from the Fluxus, but also not rebelling, but looking at, you know, how dance doesn't do that process, how dance is very rehearsed.
I quite like in the idea of the instruction set is actually the dancers crashing and having a seg fault, like we were talking about. You know, that is something to look at maybe as well, like that you know, in sort of getting performers to train, like rather than a very conscious level of asking them to rebel, but simply to get the, you know, have your rules complex enough that it's impossible.
Yeah.
And just seeing what happens, you know, in terms of, yeah, not telling people your intention necessarily and then seeing what happens, because I think that can be quite interesting. Yeah. I mean, in some of the projects I've done with live performance stuff where I set a rule for people, I'm really like begging them to break the rule, but it's like not good to tell them that they should, because, you know, then they feel a pressure to sort of pseudo-perform as opposed to just come to it really raw. And then occasionally, you know, someone would just show up in, like, literally in a bear suit and completely, you know, not do what they were asked to do.
Yeah.
And it's amazing when that happens, you know, like, it's fantastic. Yeah.
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 Well, I don't think it's about totally, like, just rebelling against the rules. I think it's about negotiating this complex system that's impossible to do and actually how that makes you react in a certain way. And it's that's the interesting part for me, is this, like, negotiation of, okay, this is going, like, some of the things that I'm thinking about with this drawing piece that I'm going to do next is sort of like, if someone, it's going to be one of those old overhead projectors with sort of grease pens. So if someone smudges it, how do I smudge my body in the space? Like, how do I actually negotiate that in the moment? So it's still, like, this complex thing that you can't dance a smudge necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think in the context of this, where you're watching the live code element of it, makes the total rebellion maybe not as interesting as just either an inability to keep up with the chain of command or just like getting it wrong or that sort of thing. Because then I think that will position the audience more actively within it. Like, it gives them more things to have to think about, because then they have to follow the score, interpret the action, and then decide not just whether it was right or wrong, but whether it was a nice wrong or a good getting it right or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I would be interested to know, like, what is kind of your intention, or maybe what is your experience with the experience of the audience in these pieces? Because, like, I have a feeling that, you know, for the dancers, it could be probably very interesting and challenging and kind of interesting experience to perform these hacks. But I'm kind of thinking that if probably I was in the audience, I would probably end up trying to read the score and trying to compare if they are sort of executing the code right, and that have some response emotional to it, that either, wow, that's great, they are breaking it down, or it's like, oh no, they're doing it wrong, or something like that. Or, so if that kind of reaction is maybe something which you actually intend for the audience, or, yeah, this kind of question.
Yeah, I think the audience has to negotiate just as much as the dancers do, yeah, and decide what is happening. Is it, yeah, is it that they are executing the code correctly? Is it, yeah, something else? I mean, the other thing is I haven't done this in front of a general audience yet. It was the three initial hacks were done in a dance department, so all dancers were watching it. The live coding with Alex was a more general audience, but it was such a messed up performance that I can't really count it.
My question is related to this. The way you code is very similar to the old way of coding. So one after another with some subroutines or something. But the new way of coding would fit very good to what you're doing, object-oriented, event-based programming.
Yeah.
Because what is the program itself is the stage, and then nothing is happening. The first thing is an event. For example, somebody is grabbing their nose or so in the audience. And then the attendees are coming, I don't know. And what an on-error event.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, my own programming experience actually started with object-oriented languages. So yeah, that is something to explore. Or, like, another thing that's interesting is things like, again, with the live coders, like Ixie Lang, Thor Magnusson's programming is like actually the proximity of words also determines particularly time elements within his sound. So like the number of spaces in between words could actually determine a time measurement. So that could be like other relationships could be explored that way. Like the actual space between dancers could indicate something. Yeah.
My suggestion is maybe to have a short break before we go on to the next presentation of Professor Herbert Lachmeier, and maybe get a bit of air into the room as well. I would suggest sort of between 5 and 10 minutes, is call back then. Okay, thank you, Kate.